You're listening to episode 380 of the Good New World Order. My name's Clatu, and in this episode, we're going to do what we've been doing for the past couple of episodes, and that is go through every single software package installed by default on Slackware Linux. Now, if you're not running Slackware Linux, that's okay. You probably have access to the software that I'm talking about because it's open source, so you can probably just install it on whatever distribution of Linux you are running from your software repository, or if you're running BSD, or even if you're running Windows or Mac, because it's open source and it's probably available for your platform. The applications that we're talking about today are, they're in the AP package set, meaning that they're applications without a graphical interface implied. I don't think I've really come across any in this package set that have a graphical interface. I could be just blanking on one or two. I mean, like Cups kind of has a graphical interface, but it's through a web browser. But in this episode, we're going to talk about QPDF. We're going to talk about Radeon Tool for like 10 seconds because I know nothing about it. And then RPM, which is a really fun one. And maybe we'll get to something else. I don't know, but definitely those three. So let's get started. QPDF. Sounds, if you're familiar with Linux application naming schemes, it sounds deceptive. QPDF, to me, sounds like it is a PDF viewer based on the QT toolset. And that would be a perfectly acceptable application for it to be, but it is not. It's not at all that. QPDF, I don't actually know what it stands for. Let's check it out and see if the man page tells us. Man, QPDF. No, it doesn't tell me. So I thought maybe it meant query PDF, maybe that could be it. Or maybe they just liked the way that the lowercase q and the lowercase p looked together. That is kind of nice. So QPDF, PDF transformation software, that's what it does. And the format of the command is QPDF, that's the name of the software. And then some options, the input file, and then the output file. It's pretty simple. So the idea is that this is going to convert one PDF file to another equivalent PDF file, but it has a bunch of options that you might be able to invoke on the way from one to the other. So to get the full explanation, I guess, the dash dash help, QPDF dash dash help, and actually I'm going to do that again. I'm going to type it through most, and there we go. So it opens up telling us that the basic options include dash dash password equals the password, dash dash linearize to generate a linearized, that is, web optimized file, dash dash copy dash encryption, copy the encryption parameters from a specified file, dash dash encryption file password equals then some password. So you can tell that this is going to work on whatever PDF you throw at it, whether it's password protected or not. You can also set properties in a PDF, again, from one PDF to another on the way of copying the data from one PDF to the one that you're transforming it into. You can set properties. So for instance, and these are silly properties to me personally, maybe you'll have a use for them, I do not. But there are things like dash dash print, and then you can tell it yes or no, y or n, and that will allow printing of the PDF. Dash dash modify equals yes or no, allow document modification. Dash dash extract, allow text and graphic extraction. Dash dash annotate, allow comments and form fill-in and signing. So you're sort of like unlocking these stupid features that are just arbitrary. Well, not arbitrary, but they're those annoying quote-unquote features of a software package where the minute someone throws it in front of you, the only thing you can think of is, how do I destroy this? How do I get rid of it? How do I get around this? That's kind of how I feel about most PDFs in general, much less the PDFs that block you from doing something that obviously you should be able to. Now, I understand there are different requirements for different tasks, different jobs. And sometimes you do need PDFs that, I guess, that people can't print. I don't know why you would need that, because I would imagine you having a PDF. If you gave me a PDF that I couldn't print, and I found out that I couldn't print it, I would immediately just, if nothing else, I would take screenshots of each page and then print each page just to have said that I've done it. That's what I think about that kind of technology. Now, I understand, though, that there's probably a need for this, or else it wouldn't exist, I guess. I don't know that I agree with it either way, but I understand that my use case and my personal beliefs over digital information, it doesn't apply to everything. So if you need those features, if you need to you have to activate or deactivate those features, then QPDF may be able to help you. So there are a lot of different options for that sort of thing, which, again, I don't have a whole lot of interest in. And so I'm not going to go over like every single, you know, the fine grain controls that you have over how you allow it to be printed, whether it's full or only low resolution and so on. So these are switches that you're flipping in the PDF data that gets written out into whatever, you know, output.pdf that you're generating by passing it through QPDF or by processing it with QPDF. You can also allow certain pages to be selected from one or more PDF if you're constructing, if you're sort of combining PDFs. And this could be useful. I don't use this for that task, but mostly because I didn't know this existed until I was looking at the next couple of applications that I had to cover, you know, within 2 weeks. And so I discovered this one. And this is kind of nice. So let's say I've got a couple of PDFs here that I should be able to do this on. So if I do QPDF, and the syntax is a little bit weird, and I will readily admit that. I do not love the syntax, and that'll probably keep me from using this in real life, to be honest. So apparently, arbitrarily, I need to give it a file name. I don't exactly know why, because I'm going to give it the same file name in a minute to define which page I want. So anyway, I'm going to go, let's do PowerTop, because that's the PDF that I have. And I know that was something like 10 pages. So then I'm going to do, so QPDF, powertop_users_guide.pdf, --pages. And I'll do one, now let's do three, now let's do one, comma, and then we'll do like 4-5. So that's defining the page. I want the one, page one, that'll be the cover. And then just randomly 4-5, I'll also take those pages. Now I need to tell it another PDF. So here is a stats.pdf. So I'll grab that. I don't know how many pages that is, so I'm just going to grab page one from that. And then --blah.pdf. And that didn't work, probably because of that comma. It should have worked. So instead, I'm just going to take 1-5. Oh no, I know why, because I forgot to give it the name of the PDF. So the full command: QPDF powertop.pdf --pages powertop.pdf 1, 4-5, and then stats.pdf 1-blah.pdf. So in other words, for some reason, you have to give QPDF an input file name. Not all of the input file names, just one of the input files that you want to deal with. You give it that, or else this will error out. And then you do --pages, which is the option to tell it, hey, I'm telling you a page range now. So then you give it an input file again, one that you want to select pages from. So in this case, that's PowerTop again, .pdf. And then the pages that you want to extract, so in this example, I'm doing 1 and then 4. And then 5. And then you give it the next PDF that you want it to extract pages from. So in this example, stats.pdf. And I wouldn't swear to more than one page being in that PDF, so we'll just extract page 1 from that. And then you have to tell it, okay, that's it, stop. And you do the --- trick to sort of like terminate options. And then you give it the output file name. So I've just done that, and now I'm gonna open up blah.pdf and xpdf, and it looks like, yes, I've got a 4-page document, and the first one is the PowerTop cover page. That's obvious to see. 4 is page 4 from that manual. 5 is page 5 from that manual. And then the final one is this stats document that I happened to have in this demo directory. So it worked as designed. This previously, the only way I knew to do that work was with PDFTK, that's PDF Toolkit, which honestly has since kind of, for me, been displaced by PDFTK-Java, which is well worth looking at. Neither of those are included, I don't think, in Slackware. I used to use PDFTK, well, I use PDFTK all the time. I used to use it all the time on all systems, and then on Fedora, something broke between PDFTK and I think it must have been a libpoplar or something like that, and I could not get PDFTK to install on Fedora, but someone has re-implemented the whole thing in Java, and so now it just works everywhere again, so it's really great. So check that out if you do a lot of slicing and dicing of PDFs. But QPDF apparently does it as well. Like I say, that syntax is really weird, and I'm not 100% sure that I'll remember it. But then again, I don't know. It is, you know, once you figure it out, it's not that bad. So that's cutting up a PDF with QPDF, and there are other options too. It'll do fancy things like collate QPDF dash dash collate odd dot PDF dash dash pages odd dot PDF even dot PDF dash dash all dot PDF, and then you've got all of your pages collated between the odds and the even. And once again, that syntax of like, hey, I'm going to randomly throw a file name at an option, and then I'm going to pass another option that requires that same file name. I mean, it really does not make this what I would call intuitive. In fact, I would even go so far as to say possibly that it's counterintuitive. I'm sure there's a very good reason for it though. Like in terms of like, hey, we had to do it this way because we're using this programming language and it makes sense for what we're doing. And if we require a file name here and then that same file name there, then we don't have to worry about whether an option is sometimes a Boolean and then sometimes not. It's a lot easier to parse that way, so just deal with it. I'm fine with that. I think it's really cool that QPDF just has been sitting on my computer for I don't know how long, and I just never really noticed it. And so yeah, it's a useful little toolkit. But I mean, this I don't know what I'm about to tell you is gonna it has blown my mind, and it's probably gonna blow your mind. It's kind of hilarious, but this is I mean, if you need proof, I can. You let me know, and I'll sit down with you and show you that this actually works. But here's this QPDF thing, and I cannot swear that this is going to work for everything. It's just something random that I discovered. So I don't generally have PDFs that are password protected. That's not really a world that I have to deal with on a regular basis. Most of the PDFs that I do get in real life on a day-to-day basis, well, it wouldn't be day-to-day, but you know, on a weekly basis, would be related to role-playing games, tabletop role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons, that sort of thing. That market, the digital market for those, is just steeped in PDF format. And that's largely, I think, because a lot of their actual targets are books, actual physical books that you buy from a store and put on your bookshelf. And since PDF it has grown from PostScript, which is the language of printers, the graphical language of printers, that's what proofs are done in. When you after you're done with the layout of a book, you send it to your printer as a PDF, and they print it from that PDF. So it's pretty trivial then to take that book layout and just leave it as a PDF and sell the PDF online, and that's what a lot of people do. So a lot of times when if you get into that hobby and you're doing it digitally, which a lot of people are doing now, you'll end up with PDFs, more PDFs than you want. And sometimes some of those PDFs are password protected. I understand why they do that because I mean I'm assuming I understand. I assume that it's got something to do with protecting, you know, ensuring that they get income for the product that they've released. And I understand that, and that goes back to what I was saying about those funky little switches in the PDF format that QPDF enables. I understand that there's a place for that. But if I've purchased the PDF, sometimes there's something in there that I want to, for instance, print out. And I mean, all the PDFs that I've bought, as far as I know, will let me print a page out. But in some cases, what I really want to do is take a map or an asset, without getting into too many details about tabletop gaming things. I'll take a page, and I want to like cut it out, like cut out the part, just the part that I want to print. I don't want all the text around it or the fancy backgrounds that they would have had, you know, if you bought the physical media, it would have all the stuff in the background. I don't want that. I specifically just want this part because I want to save on ink or whatever. And what the password protection often does is it blocks me from being able to do that. It doesn't let me then import just page 5 where the map is into Inkscape so I can mask out all the junk around it, or maybe I want to put numbers on the map and so that I can keep track of stuff, you know, whatever. It doesn't let me do that. So that's been a problem. And in order to get around that, you basically have to crack the PDF. So funny story, and again, I've only tested this on a couple of PDFs, but so far it has worked. And the thing that has worked is if I go to QPDF and I feed it qpdf space dash dash decrypt. I mean, this seems too easy already, right? And then path to the encrypted PDF that I want to remove encryption from, and then output.pdf. It just runs without complaint, which I thought at the time, I thought, well, that's too good to be true. That cannot possibly have worked. It must have done something and failed to tell me that it did the thing. Nope. XPDF output.pdf. There's the PDF in all of its glory, just as I left it, except presumably without any of the encryption. Can this be possible? Well, let's look. Let's test it out. I happen to know that PDF TK would not allow me to split up an encrypted PDF. So let's pretend again that the map that I want to print is on page 5. So I'll do PDF TK output.pdf cat 5. I guess that was a weird choice, actually. Page 5, cat 5. Anyway, cat 5, and then we'll do output, and then we'll call it map.pdf, and it did it. Now, if I do that same thing on the original encrypted PDF, just to test it here, original PDF, cat 5, output map.pdf, it gives me an error. It says, errors encountered, no output created, owner password required but not given, or incorrect. So, it definitely just stripped the encryption out of the PDF without the password. That this can't work for every PDF, right? Like, that cannot be possible. But for my purposes, this does exactly what I need it to do. All I need now is a qpdf command to detect encryption so that I can loop over my entire folder of purchased RPG PDFs and strip out all encryption so that I don't have to do this like every time I encounter it. That would be brilliant. And it's just sitting here on my computer, and it has been all this time. So I don't know if that's a known feature. I don't know if that's a feature that is intended, but boy, is it nice. And now I can take that map into Inkscape. I can mask out all the junk around it and then print it on my printer and not use up half as much ink as I would have had to do otherwise. It's brilliant. So that is qpdf. Try it out if you need to remove encryption from PDFs, apparently, or also just slice and dice. That's always useful as well. Those two things make that application, honestly, those two things make the price of Slackware completely worth it for me. Being able to cut up PDFs and decrypt them, that makes the, what did I spend on Slackware, $50, whatever it costs for Slackware, that makes it totally worth it. That program alone, for as much as I do it, you know, like every weekend when I play my game on Sunday, I'm doing exactly this. I'm cutting up a PDF for quick, you know, to just slim down what I actually need for that gaming session, so I'm not flipping through, you know, 100 pages or something. I just want that one chapter so that I don't have to have as much as to deal with, or I'm printing out a map for reference or something like that. QPDF has made Slackware 100% worth the $49 that I paid for it, or whatever I paid for it. Okay, next up, let's talk about Radeon Tool. Radeon Tool is a configuration application for ATI, as it used to be called, but I guess now it's probably AMD, for AMD cards. And it has about 9 options. There's debug, there's skip 1, like skip equals and then some integer, and that would say, okay, well, don't use this Radeon card, use the next one. Or you could do skip 2, and then you skip the first 2, and so on. DAC on or off, that's power down the external video outputs. Light on or off, power down the backlight. Stretch on, off, vertical, horizontal, so that's stretching for resolution mismatch on your display. I don't know that I ever fully understood how sort of graphics got onto the screen for a very, very long time, until I started building my own computers. That was the thing that really made it, like, really made it all come together. Because if you're just a person with a laptop or a tower that you built, that you bought off the shelf of a store, then sort of all you see the computer, and then you look for the video outputs, and all you know is that if you attach this cable to that port, then magic happens. Something pops up on your screen. And if it doesn't look good enough, then you understand that, well, first you think, okay, well, I just need to go to settings and adjust the resolution or something. And then if that doesn't work, or if the maximum resolution is like 1024 by 768, then you realize, oh, okay, I need to install a driver. So then you install a driver, and then somehow more magic happens, and then the image is produced. And it wasn't until I started building my own computer that I kind of realized how it was all happening. On towers, which I think is probably the best way to kind of comprehend it, generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, that motherboard parts, the big circuit board that you put into the tower, there's a little chip on that. And a lot of times it's by either AMD or Intel. And sometimes it's by some other manufacturer. It doesn't have to be one of those. It could be, what are some of the others? Was the one that I was thinking of, VIA or something like that. But yeah, so they exist. There's a little chip on there. And out of that chip, or, you know, attached to that chip eventually, there's a video output port. And if you plug a cable into that output port, then it sends a digital signal to activate pixels on your display. And that's working. The thing about those little chips is that they're rather limited in how much they can process. And so they're designed, I mean, by design, they are limited. Because people know that if they make them very, very capable, very powerful, then, well, the chip, you know, probably needs to be bigger, or it needs more memory, or it needs something to take the heat away from it, because now you're crunching lots and lots of numbers and sending a lot of electricity through there, and the heat starts to build up, and so on. So those built-in chips, if there is a built-in chip, they tend to be designed to be relatively low-powered. It's not a whole lot of data rushing through there. It's designed to be kind of a basic output. And if that's all you need, like all you need the computer to do is like maybe give you a basic graphical interface, if that, then that's often all you need. And then that's great, because now all you've done is you've paid for a motherboard and you haven't had to go spend the extra money on a graphics card. If you do go out and buy a separate card, then you've got this card, you've got a graphics chip on that card that maybe is a little bit more than what was set into the motherboard. Maybe it's a little bit more powerful, maybe. Maybe not. I mean, if it's a $30 card, then it's probably basically the same thing. It's just on a separate card, and same chip, different card. So you slot that in there, and now you've got a different output in the back of your computer. Now, the cool thing is, if you have two monitor outputs in the back of your computer, that doesn't mean that they're redundant. You could actually potentially put a cable into each of those outputs and put those cables into two separate monitors, and now suddenly you have two monitors showing you a feed of your computer. And Linux is smart enough, and most operating systems now are smart enough, to recognize that those are two cables attached to the same computer. Therefore, you know, it's basically getting the same kind of set of information. And then it's up to the graphic layer of your computer. In Slackware's case, that's X11 or Zorg or X, or X386 if you go far enough back. Then it's up to that graphical layer. On modern Linux, it would be Wayland, or more modern Linux. I mean, Slackware 14.2 is modern Linux, but something very cutting edge, it would be Wayland. It's up to that graphics layer to recognize that, okay, these two signals are being sent. You know, there's two graphical outputs, so I'm going to send one desktop to one of them and another desktop to another, and those will be two unique spaces. Workspaces for my user. And you can usually configure that in one of, you know, several different ways. Sometimes they are distinct desktops, sometimes they're just one big long desktop that sort of spans both windows, both monitor windows, as it were. It depends on how you and your graphical graphic layer kind of interact and set things. So to get even fancier now, you could buy a really powerful graphics card and add it to your computer and have yet another output, or maybe that would be your primary output. That's generally what I do. I get a really nice graphics card and I have one monitor, because for some reason, I don't know, I just very used to one monitor and not used to lots of monitors. Lots of monitors are nice, I will admit that, but they do take up a lot of room. So yeah, you can do that. You have lots of monitors, or you have one card and just use that as your primary card. Sometimes a card has multiple outputs, so you've got that option. Now the bigger cards, they usually have a bigger chip on them, a more powerful chip, and it usually generates heat. And so you'll see graphic cards with like fans on them, like fans just for the graphic part. And you'll definitely see that on, you know, a gaming computer or something like that, because the CPU of your computer might be generating a considerable amount of heat. But boy, those graphic cards, they're like a whole other computer on a card. I mean, they really are. They're really, really powerful computational devices. They just happen to have as their primary output, they're outputting graphical data. And the driver that you may or may not need to install for a graphics card or a graphics chip is simply a way for the Linux kernel to talk to that graphics chip. Because most graphic chips have, well, I think all graphic chips now have as a built-in sort of lowest denominator format something called VESA. I'm assuming it's pronounced Visa. I've never actually heard it pronounced. And this is different from the Visa mounting spec for like monitors and televisions and so on. This is a driver, the Visa driver. And this is distributed, the Visa driver, Visa driver, is distributed by X11, the free desktop folks. It is a generic video driver for basically all cards. I guess maybe not all of them, but there's a standard you know, set of information that a graphics card is going to output, and this driver can tap into that and interpret it and display it on your screen. The downside to that driver, that magical driver, is that it may only be bringing in an 800 by 600 resolution display, because anything more powerful than that, then you need to know more details about what exactly that card is feeding out, is outputting. But for the VESA core, there's a standard output, and this driver that ships, if you've installed X, then you've installed this driver. And that just, the benefit there is that when you plug in a monitor to Linux, or like you plug in a display into your Linux box, you get a display, you get a picture. It might not be pretty, it might be, the resolution may be comically low, but you do get an image. And that's important for lots of different reasons. I mean, a lot of tools on Linux are just easier to sort of interface with over a graphical interface. I mean, not necessarily. You can usually use them without. Hopefully, you can. But some of the low level, or the, yeah, I guess low level things are really just, they're easier if you do it over the graphical display, like getting a network up and running, a network card rather, up and running. In the graphical display, it's like a click of the network manager selecting the right card and you're online. Whereas in a terminal, you have to probably, well, you have to figure it out. You know, what do? You activate Network Manager and then use NMCLI to list your connections and, well, list your devices, list your connections, and then connect or activate one of those connections. Or do you just go with iwconfig and diffconfig? I mean, how would you do it? It's up to you. So the graphical sort of the default, the fallback to graphics is kind of, it's a feature. It is nice. It's a nice to have. And if you've got that set up, then you've got sort of a pretty reliable way of getting an image on a computer. And for a lot of people, that's kind of a source of a lot of sort of comfort. And I don't mean that in a sarcastic way. I mean, really, it is comforting to see, okay, I am 70% of the way there. I've got Linux installed and I've got a display. The display is comically low res, but that I think I can fix. And you can usually. It usually involves installing a driver that will talk to your graphics card or graphics chip in on a more advanced level. And that's not so hard usually. It's usually just looking in your software repository, or in the case of Slackware, you can just go download the driver, like if it's an NVIDIA driver or whatever AMD's driver is these days. You get it from slackbuilds.org. You build your own kernel, you install NVIDIA, you know, whatever, however you want to do it, it's something that you can do and fix. All of that has almost nothing to do with the Radeon tool. I just wanted to go over that because I think it's useful to get a little bit of context sometimes. Radeon tool, I've never used. I will probably never use it because honestly, I kind of avoid AMD slash ATI graphic cards. I've had bad experiences with them in the past. I have not tried them lately. It's been 6 years since I've tried one. Maybe they've gotten a lot better. That's the Radeon tool. Okay, let's talk coffee. I am going to go get some coffee, and you really ought to yourself as well, because after the coffee break, we're going to go over RPM. That is the RPM Package Manager.
Thank you.
RPM stands for literally the RPM Package Manager. It is a recursive acronym developed by Red Hat as a means of making the process of installing packages easier on the user. And it would do that by keeping track of what was or was not installed on your system. Now, I'm going to mention here that I don't have a very historical background or context for RPM. By the time I started using Linux, Yum was a thing already, and Yum abstracted a whole lot of the RPM experience away from the user. So as I understand it, and I'm going to kind of gloss over this pretty quickly in case I'm very, very wrong, and I urge you that if on Slackware, for instance, and this would have been true for early Linux as I understand, on Slackware, you can install software, let's say, two different ways. There are more ways, but let's sort of say, okay, two common ways of Slackware software installation. You can go grab the source code, you compile it, you turn it into a package, you install the package, and you're done. So it's about four different steps or so, four or five different steps. It depends on, you know, how you're defining steps, but also it depends on if you're using a front end, because certainly Slack builds does a lot of the work for you. And then if you use a front end for Slack builds, then you've got something like SBOPKG doing all the work for you practically. So it can be very, very fast. It can be very quick and transparent, or it can be very manual. By the way, not a big deal. But in that process, if you've ever compiled code, then you'll know that when you're compiling code, this code is being translated, this code that was typed by a human is being translated into machine language. And in order for it to do that correctly, sometimes the code, the compiler has to have a library available to it, some other code, some code that someone else wrote. And the compiler takes a little bit of code from there, that library, and combines it with the stuff or puts it into the code that it's compiling over here, and so on. And that's what's happening during that code compile process. Now, if you are trying to compile code, for instance, that makes great use of libfoo, and you don't have libfoo installed on your system, specifically the development headers of libfoo, usually, then the compile will fail. It will stop compiling, because at some point that compiler is looking out on your system in some predefined directories that generally on Linux, that's where we keep our libraries, like /usr/lib64 or /lib64 or /user/local/lib64, whatever it might be. It's going out there searching those paths, and it's not finding a libfoo. And so it can't pull the code that it needs in order to sort of complete that puzzle that the source code is that needs libfoo. And obviously we do this as programmers because it is easier to simply reuse code out of libfoo than to reinvent the wheel and rewrite everything ourselves in our own code. Now, that's one of the ways that code works. It's the reason that it's modular. And of course, with open source, you have the opportunity to do that a lot because there's so much that you're allowed to pull from. So during the process of compiling, the compiler will stop if it cannot find the dependencies, the code that it depends on. It will stop and it will tell you, sometimes in a very clear way and sometimes with just a weird looking error that takes you a lot of research to understand what it means, but it'll tell you that you don't have libfoo, and then you know, oh, I gotta go install libfoo now. And like I say, sometimes that is literally cannot find libfoo. Oh, well, that's easy, so I need to install libfoo. And other times it's a little bit more cryptic because it just stops and it says cannot find, I don't know, IEC_FFO.something. And then you have to think, oh, well, what provides whatever I just said, and how do I get it? And then you have to do a little bit of research to figure out why that thing broke when it was trying to do this action, you know, and it leads you back, ideally, eventually, to the fact that you needed libfoo. And then you go read the README file that you ignored, and you realize it says right at the top of the document, requires libfoo. Okay, so that's compiling from source code. The other way is to just go grab a package that someone has already done all of that before you, and packaged it up, and put the package online. That's called getting a binary distribution, or sometimes just called a software package. And for Slackware, you would go to some place that had Slackware binaries on it, like Alien Bob's server. He compiles a bunch of stuff like KDE and VLC and Handbrake and probably a bunch of other stuff that I'm not thinking of, too, BitTorrent. Lots of stuff, right? He puts it on his server and you can go get it. It's pre-compiled. It is done already. You don't have to do any of that stuff. Now, the thing about Slackware, and this is how it's an example for RPM, the thing about Slackware is that when you're compiling that source code, you get those warnings, right? Whether you understand them or not, you get warnings that it's telling you, hey, you don't have libfoo installed. You need to do that, or I won't work. I cannot compile this code. You cannot launch this program until you get libfoo, come back and compile this, and then you can install it and launch it. So that's sort of dependency checking for you. It's not super friendly, I guess. And the way I'm describing it, certainly it is a little bit of trial and error, but it does work. Whereas for Slackware, the binary install, if you point Slack PKG at a Slack package, bar -1.0.0-x86_64.tgz or txz or whatever, then it'll install that. It basically unarchives it and puts all those files in the package on your system in the corresponding positions, and it never checks any kind of dependency. So you may install this bar or baz program, whatever it is, and then you go to launch it, and then it errors out. So say, I can't launch. And maybe it'll tell you, can't find libfoo.so or something like that. Or maybe it'll just crash and you'll have to once again kind of investigate, well, why did it tell me it couldn't launch? And there's a couple of different ways you can do that. You can do LDD on the binary that you were trying to launch to see what kind of libraries it links out to and so on. But there was nothing stopping you from installing that package, even though you didn't have libfoo installed on your system. And that's a good thing and it's a bad thing. I mean, it's a bad thing because you might think, cool, I just installed all the packages I need, and you actually didn't, and that could be annoying. But I mean, it really is quite nice when you're, let's say, rebuilding a system and you have all the packages in a directory that's the standard package collection for the systems that you're building. You can just point install PKG at that directory and say, all of the T?Z's in that directory, make them be on the system. And as long as you know that that's the same collection that interacts with each other and resolves each other's dependencies successfully, then by the time they're on the system, everything works. So RPM is kind of in the middle. RPM, generally speaking, unless you're getting a source RPM, is a binary distribution. So it's like that TGZ or TXZ or whatever that you've downloaded from Alien Bob or Slack Only or whatever. You grab the RPM, you go to install it with RPM, RPM --install, and RPM checks to verify whether or not it's sensible for you to install that RPM. And if it is not, then it doesn't, at least by default, it does not allow you to install the package because it knows that it will not function. It knows that it will not be able to successfully run whatever is contained in that RPM until you install the whatever is missing. So it's acting a little bit like a source code compile process, even though it's binary. And I have to kind of say that that's both good and bad, because on one hand, it's good because that way you're not fooling yourself. You know exactly what you need to do to make this thing work. So for instance, if I'm on Slackware and I pull down an RPM for ARIA2C, that's a downloader. It's quite a nice downloader, like wget, but multi-threaded, I guess you could say multi-threaded. I don't know if it's multi-threaded. Is there another term for that? I don't know. So if I do RPM --install ARIA2C --RPM, hit return, it does not install it for me, and it tells me that it needs libc.so.6 and a bunch of other things. So it's telling me straight away that this isn't going to work if I install it. Now, here's the thing about RPM. RPM is kind of an all or nothing system. So RPM, let me look at what kind of libc I actually do have in my system. That'd be glibc or something like that, or libc.so.6. So if I look in ls slash, or if I list slash lib64 slash libc.so, well, if I look in lib64 slash libc asterisk, then I see that the libc version that I am running on this Slackware computer is libc.so.6. And that is exactly what this aria2c RPM just warned me that I did not have. Was it incorrect? Well, not really. It's correct. I do not have the glibc RPM installed on my system. Do I have libc installed? Why, yes, I do. But it's outside the RPM system. I did not install it through RPM. So RPM is more or less useless on Slackware because no matter what you try to install through RPM, it will not recognize what you have on your system as valid. So in order, if you really wanted to use RPM, I don't even know if this is possible, you really wanted to know to use it, you would have to install at least, like, well, I mean, probably everything that you see in the A package set of Slackware. You have to install, not everything, all those AAA ones in the A package set, you'd have to install with RPM, such that then you could install the RPMs that depend on those obvious things. Like libc is practically pretty much always going to be an unresolvable but required dependency for whatever you try to do. And I even tested that out. So I have a little script. It's just a bash script. It's called trashy, and it is a trash command for your terminal, which I highly recommend. You should never, ever, ever use the rm command ever again in your life. I could talk more about that at some point. I'm sure I probably will. And it's a bash script, this trashy thing. It's not fancy. It is, it's, well, it is, I mean, it's a big script, but in terms of what it requires to have on your system, not a whole lot. It's a very basic RPM. It's probably a really nice little RPM to learn how to build RPMs from, because it does use all the sort of the really basic features of RPM and RPM build. But anyway, so I put it onto this, I brought that RPM over onto this Slackware machine, and it is an RPM built for Red Hat Linux 8. But there is a source package, a source RPM for it as well. And a source RPM is an RPM, but it is an RPM that hasn't really been built yet. I mean, it's an RPM that's been built in the sense it's an RPM. But if you wanted to, you know, the process of installing the source RPM would require that RPM to compile the code. They're kind of nice, but they are a little bit more, they're a little bit more, there are more steps involved. But what they're primarily used for, I believe, is such that so that you can, as a user, rebuild the source RPM to create a valid RPM for your system, but still retain the benefits of, hey, I've compiled this myself on my system, whatever that might be. And I've done it, I've had to do it a couple of times, and I don't for the life of me remember what the impetus was. But let's just pretend like, I don't know, for some reason you got libfoo 4.0 on your system, and the package that you want to install was written with libfoo, well, 3 or 5 in mind. Then you might have to rebuild so that it would then build against libfoo 4 instead of 3 or 5. Now, in practice, there's a little bit of wiggle room there because, technically speaking, sometimes, well, no, RPM wouldn't let you. So I think, yeah, I think you would have to possibly rebuild that. I was going to say, sometimes the binary would still actually work on the system, depending on the ABI difference between libfoo 4 and 5 or 3 or whatever. But the RPM would stop you because it would see that you don't have libfoo, whatever I said, installed as an RPM. So you could do RPM build dash dash rebuild, and then the path to the source RPM, which I'll do right now. So first of all, on a system, on to get sort of RPM up and running, you need to run, I think, just RPM, just literally the command RPM. Maybe it's RPM build. Yeah, it's RPM build. Sorry. RPM build. And this creates, at least as of the version of RPM that we're using on Slackware, running RPM build creates what's called the RPM tree, or the RPM build tree, whatever. And that is a directory simply called RPM build, and it's located in your home directory. So now that I've run RPM build, I have a directory called RPM build. So I'll go into RPM build, and I'll look around. And you'd think it would be an empty directory, but it's not. It's a whole system in here. So there's a folder called build, build root, RPMs, sources, specs, and SRPMs. Build is the place where things get built to. They get copied out of build eventually, but that's kind of the working directory to construct the RPM. Let me see if I'm getting this right. And then build root is the place where things go to be compiled, I think. I could be getting this a little bit wrong, so don't go quote me. But yeah, build and build root, one of those two, I think it's build root you go to sort of find out what broke. You know, you go there for your half-built project, essentially. That's, I know that I've been to build root for that a number of times. Okay, so then there's RPMs. Well, those are the completed RPMs, and in there's going to be potentially a no arch directory, and then whatever architecture you're on right now, like a x86_64. No arch being things that are architecture independent and are marked as such, and then the architecture dependent ones are obviously labeled. There's sources. That's where the source code that is required for the RPM to build. That's where the source code goes. So if you're building a package for libfoo, then you'd put the libfoo source code in sources, and then you would build your little build script. And in Slackware, we would call that a Slack build script. But for this is an RPM build script, and they call it a spec file, S-P-E-C, spec file. Spec files go into specs. That's the fifth, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah, the fifth directory over here. And then finally, there's SRPMs, and that's where source RPMs go. So if you've got a source RPM, or if you're using one of the RPM tools to grab source RPMs, then you can put them in SRPMs and rebuild them from there. So a lot of this is kind of like it maintains itself mostly. You don't tend to go into these directories all that often. Well, I mean, into RPMs you probably go frequently because that's where your finished product is. But everything else, it kind of maintains itself, to be honest. So now we've got RPM build. In theory, we could go into, let's say, the SRPMS, and we could do a wget or there used to be on some systems, there are some really handy, I don't think there is here. Yeah, on RHEL and Fedora these days, there's a tool chain called RPM dev, and I think SpecTools, and both of those are really useful because they have commands that will just really quickly grab things from here and there. But anyway, so we're just going to do a wget. We're going to do a secure copy because I actually have it on my home server. So I'm going to secure copy this trashy RPM, but the source one, so asterisk src asterisk RPM, and copy it to this directory. And so now I've got a source directory in my SRPMS folder. And now I can do an RPM build dash dash rebuild, and then I'll give it the path to SRPMS. Trashy source, and then hit return. And so now it's taking this little source RPM and it's exploding it. I think it puts I'll verify, but I'm pretty sure that it puts the sources in the sources directory. Yes, it does, and the spec file in the spec directory. So that's kind of exploded the RPM. It hasn't installed the RPM, it's taken it apart. It's decoupled it from being an RPM package, and it's taken the source code and put it into a sane location. It's taken the spec file, put it into a nice place. And then all that while, because I used RPM dash dash rebuild, it is also, it's using the assets that it's just put into those directories. And once it is finished, and it's not going to finish. Okay, so trashy defines in the spec file. So look in the spec file, your trashy.spec. Trashy defines that it requires bash to run, bash or zsh or tcsh in order to run. So again, because RPM wants to see those RPMs installed, we need to remove that requirement. And this is, like I say, this is a really simple RPM. So you can imagine something with more than just one requirement. So I'm going to strike that line altogether from my spec file, and then do an RPM rebuild again, or RPM build dash dash rebuild, do that, let that go. Okay, so I've just finished that, and it has built successfully, so I'm finding it in RPMs slash no arch slash trashy dash 251 no arch RPM. So in theory now, I should be able to do an RPM dash dash install And I am doing that with sudo. No arch tragedy RPM. And unfortunately, it still gives me failures. It says error failed dependency slash bin slash sh is needed by trashy and slash usr slash bin slash env is needed by trashy. So it doesn't see, even for a scripted language that doesn't require really anything, nothing is defined as a requirement in the spec file. It still, it sees that as being as missing requirements. Even though, I mean, I can do an ls on bin sh and it is there. I can do an ls or a file on user bin env and it is there if I spell it correctly. So it's not missing, it's just that the RPM that would contain those elements are not found on the system by RPM. Okay, but looking at the RPM command, you see that there is a dash dash force option. So maybe we could try that. RPM dash dash install dash dash force RPMs no arch trashy asterisk RPM. No, still not gonna do it. Okay, well, we'll turn to the man page then, man RPM. And we'll look around for dependencies. And you search around for a little while and you eventually find that there is an option also that might be relevant called no depths. Forces RPM to skip dependency checking when installing, I think, or removing packages. So let's give that a go. RPM dash dash install dash dash no depths RPMs no arch trashy asterisk RPM. And it looks like it has installed that package. We can verify it with file slash usr slash bin slash trashy and says, yeah, that exists. It is a shell script, ASCII text executable. And we can test it out. So we can do touch foobar, and we can do trash foobar, and then we do trash dash dash list. And there it is, foobar. We can do trash dash dash empty, trash list. And yeah, it's empty. So there you go. It actually functions. It actually does work. So the reality of the situation now that we've gone through the whole process is that the RPM command on Slackware has limited use, at least the way that it would be traditionally utilized, I think. And that is that you could, in theory, use it to install RPMs, absolutely, but only if you tell it, if you force it to ignore what it was designed to do. I think the impetus for its design was the dependency resolution feature. And so if you turn that feature off and just use it essentially as an unarchiving and installation tool, then yes, you could use that. And that is really good to know about it. Actually, because that you know that RPMs are in a way potentially available to you on Slackware. Now, it gets even better because there are a bunch of tools designed by Patrick Volkerding to make make RPMs even easier than that to use on Slackware. And those are RPM and the number 2, RPM 2 TGZ, RPM2 TBZ, RPM2 TXZ. And those are fantastic little applications. I use them very often. And what that does is it extracts an RPM and then turns it into a Slackware package, such that when you install it, it is then, you know, it is the files and everything that gets recorded in your standard slash var slash log slash packages location. Because right now, if I were to look in slash var slash log slash packages for trashy, no, it is not there. So as far as Slackware knows, trashy is not installed. As far as RPM knows, trashy is the only thing installed. My install of Linux only features a shell script. That's all that's running this system. It's amazing. Okay, so we can kind of verify some things. We can look at, for instance, the database of RPM. So this is the equivalent of, I don't think this is a separate package. So actually, I guess I should do an ls really quick on var log packages to see what I'm supposed to be covering. Yeah, RPMDB is part of this thing. So that's good. So RPMDB is the database that RPM uses to keep track of all your packages, or that all the RPMs that you have installed on your system. And the way that you can look at that, if you really want, it's not quite as beautiful as var log packages, but you can do rpmdb dash dash export db maybe pipe it through less, or most rather, and that shows you this binary database with a very nice translation over here on the right, in the right column. For the first screenful, it doesn't look all that great, but eventually you'll see actual text that you recognize. So trashy 251, a saint RM intermediary for the POSIX shell, blah, blah, blah. And it just keeps going and going and going. So it is telling you, and it tells you, it does, you see the list of packages. So it says trashy 8GZ, trashy 2.5, readme.md, trashy.info. So it sees everything, you know, and you can see it. You can see all the things that it recorded. It's just not, it isn't plain text like varlog packages is, which is a little bit harder to parse for sure. And there may be commands in RPMDB that allow you to sort of pull out. Well, I guess there is. I mean, there's RPM. So if we do, okay, RPM-Q, L, I think that's, I guess I should actually look these up so that we know what the heck they stand for. So I'll do an RPM dash dash help, and the dash Q is for query, and the dash L is for list. I did know both of those actually, but I didn't want to get it wrong. So RPM dash dash query, dash dash list, return, trashy, return. And now it's telling it has found the entry for trashy, for the package trashy, and it lists all of the files that we did install: user bin trashy, user man man 8, trashy 8, gz, and so on. All 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 files. So if you're very clever, you could take that output and pipe it to, I don't know, like a remove or a move or something like that, or a trash, and get rid of the files that got installed on your system just by listing what the RPM put onto your system in the first place. So it's not, it's not unmanageable. This is something that you can work with. RPM dash dash query dash dash all for trashy. That shows us the packages themselves. Now again, as far as RPM knows, I only have one RPM installed on my entire system, and it is called trashy. So I'm getting like one response back on my query through all packages. But if I had 5 packages installed and then I did query all trashy, I'd still only get one response. But then if I did something, I don't know, something a little bit more or less, maybe TR, then I would get trashy probably, and then I would get maybe TR or something like that. Maybe. Actually, I don't know about that. Point being, if you want to find one package, you can do a dash dash query dash dash all to search through all packages. And then if you want to get a listing of the files contained in that package, you do a dash dash query dash dash list, and that shows you everything within that package. And there's other stuff too. There's show. Am I thinking of DNF? I might be thinking of DNF. Anyway, there's other things you can do with RPM in terms of parsing that database. And if you were to use it frequently, then you could learn those and look at them. I don't use it all that much because, again, DNF exists, and most of what RPM can do, DNF provides a front end for anyway. I have run Slack package on a system that had a sort of a database-driven package manager on it before. It worked. It actually worked because Slack package doesn't, you know, it actually looks at the system for what's available, whereas the database does the opposite. It ignores the system and looks at its own database. So running Slack package on a Debian system is totally possible. I spent at least a year, possibly more, running a Debian system on a very, very old iBook, and because that's all that iBook would run was Debian, and because I don't particularly care for apt, I decided to just port Slack package over to it, and it worked fine. I was quite happy with it. In retrospect, maybe I would have just done package source from NetBSD. Maybe that would have been a more natural fit, but I don't think I didn't feel very comfortable with package source at the time. I just decided Slack package, I know, I'll just do that, and it worked. It worked quite well. Doing the reverse, though, is a little bit tough, and because Patrick Volkerding provides RPM 2 TGZ, I don't feel like there's probably a huge advantage to using the RPM interface directly. The one advantage to it, I guess, is would be these the database functions. If for whatever reason you thought that was a superior method of tracking things, maybe that would be useful. And if you had a whole bunch of interconnected packages, maybe for some reason that would be useful to you. I can't think of what that reason would be. But maybe, I don't know, maybe that would be something that you would find useful. Because I mean, that is the nice thing about RPM is the database-driven aspect of it, meaning that you can query RPM for something that is required by another thing, or something that obsoletes another, or conflicts with something else, or provides a specific library, that sort of thing. So there are some nice kind of queries that you can make of RPM and get answers back that might be a different process with Slack package, or may not even exist with Slack package. I mean, once it's installed on your system, you really don't have access necessarily to what it required or what it provides. Well, it does. You have a very good list of what it provides. So I guess of what it required to get onto your system in the first place, I guess, would be the one thing that you kind of lose with Slack package. I mean, if you've got your build script around, certainly a slackbuild.org file structure, then you have a .info file that lists it. If it's an alien Bob script, it's probably listed somewhere in the script. So yeah, there are lots of different ways, but maybe that would be a problem if there are too many different ways. So anyway, RPM, it is a system to manage packages. It's not the system that Slackware uses, but Slackware uses or enables you to use RPMs through both the RPM system, the RPM build system, and the RPM2 TGZ script, which technically I'm not supposed to be talking about right now because it's not on this list. It's not in the AP package set. So just focus on RPM, RPMDB, and RPM build, and so on. Those are the tools surrounding RPM that Slackware provides. Well, I mean, there are some of the tools that it provides. Technically, Slackware provides quite a lot, and I'm going to read them off really quick to see if they're useful to talk about. There's GenDiff, there's RPM2 Archive, RPM2 CPIO. Now, that's the one that RPM2 TGZ uses, RPM2 CPIO, so 2 CPIO, because that translates the package into the CPIO archive format, which it then uses to grab everything out of. RPM build, we talked about it. RPM DB, talked about it. RPM graph, let's not worry about it. RPM keys and RPM sign. Oh, and RPM spec. So keys and sign, that has to do with if you're signing the RPM or checking the signatures of the RPM. It's important, but probably more important if you're packaging and actually sending packages out, or if you need to verify the authenticity of a package. Because that's another thing that DNF kind of abstracts away from you, is it imports those keys, and you all of the packages that you're downloading and installing onto your system are being checked and verified against a known good key set, like encryption key for digital signatures. And then there's RPM spec, which is a command to help you query spec files. And then there's RPM spec, which is a command to help you query spec files. Not that big of a deal. I kind of wanted to go over spec files and how they work, but I'm not going to because I'm kind of running out of time. I don't want this to go on forever because, like I say, RPM has a very limited use case on Slackware. It's really only included, as far as I know, because of that, those one or two things that RPM2 TGZ wants to use in order to make it super easy for you to convert from RPM to a Slackware package. Okay, so a spec file, it is a script with a bunch of macros in it. And by macros, I mean functions that are defined by someone else that you can then reuse in a script. There's a very specific format to a spec file. There is a whole series of linting commands that you can do to make sure that your spec file is valid. If you ever show a spec file to someone who makes RPMs for a living, they will critique it. What's the expression, like 2 days until Sunday or something like that? They will critique it nonstop. They will tell you everything that's wrong with it. This is from experience. So great. Spec files, very strictly formatted, very significant because it defines the metadata, the requirements, the build requirements, the description, and then the build process, and the change log. This is one thing I really like about a spec file, is that it is everything about the RPM in one file. So an RPM really, well, there are exceptions, but in theory, a spec file is an RPM is a spec file and source code. And that's, in theory, that's all you need for an RPM. Now, in practice, you see other things thrown into an RPM out of necessity, because maybe you need a patch, or maybe you need, I don't know, some asset that isn't normally bundled with that source code, like an icon, or some form of documentation that really needs to be bundled, but it isn't, so on. So a spec file, though, it's got everything sort of about that package all in one place, which I quite like. And I'm comparing that to, for instance, slackbuilds.org, which splits out a lot of information into like three different files. If you go look at a Slack build from slackbuild.org, there is the Slack build itself, a .info file, which contains sort of like the download location and the maintainer's name and some other information. I'm not entirely sure why that wouldn't be in the Slack build file. I don't know why they thought that should be a different thing. Presumably for some kind of, you know, predictable parsing arrangement, but I don't know. Yeah, so it's not in the build file. And then there's a slack-desc, which is the description of the package, and that's yet another file. So spec file, everything's all in one, and it is kind of that. I think to its detriment, there are a bunch of macros that if you're familiar with the shell, the bash script or how to use a shell, I should say, then you're familiar with how to build a Slack build. You do in the Slack build exactly what you would do in the terminal, basically. That's all it is. I mean, there are certain nice things that people do in their Slack builds, like checking the architecture and setting the version number with a variable instead of hard coding it. They hard code it somewhere, but throughout, you know, they have conventions that they do. You'll see conventions in Patrick's Slack build. You'll see conventions in Alien Bob's Slack build. You'll see conventions in slackbuilds.org. But generally speaking, it's a valid Slack build if it's a shell script that builds a package and makes it into a Slack package. Whereas the spec file, you kind of have to learn RPM, because there are macros in there that you won't understand the significance of. They'll just be like percent, some command percent, or some command, and you won't know what that means. So there is a learning curve to just drumming up a spec file. But once you've gotten over a very little learning curve, you can do very basic spec files. The more complex the build, of course, the more complex your spec file may end up becoming. But honestly, even for just like for Trashy, because Trashy is built around auto tools, the build instructions for it are just, they're just the auto tools commands, and that's it. You're done. Well, you're not entirely done. You still have to list out all the files and stuff like that. There's a bunch of sort of bureaucracy involved in a spec file, but it's relatively simple to do a relatively simple RPM. And even if your RPM requires, like if your build requires one or two patches or the incorporation of an external source, it's not a whole lot to learn. Now you start straying away from auto tools, and now your build is going to become a little bit more complex, because maybe you're going to have to make sure that you've got, I don't know, Meson or Meson, whatever that, Meson, and Ninja, those build tools, or maybe it's a Python package, and now you have to worry about how that's being done, and so on. So it can get complex, and I guess at that point, it's just a question of getting to know the different systems. But in terms of learning how to do a spec file, it isn't impossible. It's just, it's learning a new format. It's learning a new way of expressing the same commands that you're doing somewhere else in a different way. And I think that's the frustrating part when I'm learning something. If I know how to do it one way, then the mental effort to convince myself that it is then worth doing a different way, there's that takes a lot, because I just think, well, why don't I just not do it as an RPM then? I'll just do it over here, package it up, and then I'll be done. And that's the liberating thing about Slack builds, because more than likely, if you're at the point of thinking, I want to make a Slack build for something, then quite probably you're familiar with the idea that code can be compiled. And so really, you're automating a thing that you are already doing in the exact same language that you're doing it. That's really, really nice, a big feature of Slack package, and not to be discounted. I'm sure there's a lot of benefits to spec files, but I do wonder if there would be a sort of a market, or an audience, I should say, for an RPM format that throws away a lot of those conventions and just says, hey, look, you give me the structure of files as you want it applied to your computer, I will wrap it in an RPM for you. But it just wouldn't work, because, you know, all that metadata and stuff has to get recorded somehow, and that's up to you. So that's the RPM command. and the RPM structure. It is an interesting way to do things. There are advantages and disadvantages, and on Slackware, I don't think it's likely that you're going to use it, but you can hack around it because it is included in on your distribution. You can use the tools that it provides you to look at RPMs or to disassemble them or to just get around them and convert them into a Slack package. That's it. That's everything. That's RPM. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Thank you for listening to the GNU World Order podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Oh, it's so beautiful, Tree!